You're listening to Stephen Maggi, host of one of America's top interview programs, The Stephen Maggi Show.
Hello and welcome. I'm Stephen Maggi. One of the most important moments in United States history happened back in 1974 when President Richard Nixon became the only president in history to actually resign from office, and an unelected vice president took over with really the weight of the world on his shoulders. And as historians look back, they're finding more and more that Gerald Ford really did a fantastic job in a very difficult situation. And we have an eyewitness to history with us today, really fortunate to have a guy named Bill Brockett. He was part of the White House military staff and a personal advisor to President Ford. He was there. He's one of the few people ever to actually see all this stuff transpire. I mean, we just want to talk to him about what happened in those days and really about the life and times of Gerald Ford as well. Bill, welcome. So how do you get there? I mean, first of all, let's take us to the point right before President Nixon resigned. How would you get there, and talk a little about some of the things you saw in those last final days of President Nixon?
I worked in videotape recording in the executive office building, which is within the White House compound. So you basically have the White House itself, which exists of the residence, the east and west wing, and then directly across West Executive Avenue within the White House fence is the executive office building. So that's actually where I worked. And then, leading up, well, I arrived at the White House on July the 1st, 1974. So a month and 9 days before Nixon actually left office. Early in August, things began to really heat up. One of the things that we were doing in videotape recording, we recorded basically the news. Back in those days, ABC, NBC, CBS, and PBS. We didn't have the 24-hour cable news programs at that time. And, of course, the majority of the news at that time was related to Watergate. And special reports would be issued during the day that we would catch and tape. And all of those tapes were then forwarded on a weekly basis to the National Archives. A couple of days before the resignation speech, which I believe was on August 8th, I was in the West Wing I can't remember exactly what I was doing, but I was walking down the hallway from the door to the Oval Office toward the press secretary's office. And a Secret Service agent came up to me and took me by the arm and opened a closet door, pushed me in the closet and told me to stay there until he let me out. And so I stood in the dark in a coat closet in the West Wing of the White House and heard footsteps shuffle by. And I heard voices, and I could hear President Nixon's voice. And after all the people walked by, they had come over from the residence. This agent let me out of the closet and told me that he apologized and said Mr. Nixon had told them that he did not want to see anybody, and they were trying their best to accommodate that. So, wow. So I spent a couple of minutes there standing in the dark in the closet just wondering exactly what that was all about. But obviously, at that time, the atmosphere in Washington, and particularly in the West Wing of the White House, was intense.
Yeah, it sounds very dark and paranoid. Wow, what a thing. So then you're in that room when he makes his resignation speech. You were really one of just a small handful of people that actually were there when that happened.
That's true. The day of the resignation speech, August the 8th, we began to be told, you know, things that we needed to do to get set up. The president had requested airtime from all the major networks that evening. Very few people actually knew. I don't know exactly who all knew, but I know some people who did know and who didn't know. The people who knew what he was going to do was his family, his photographer, Vice President Ford, of course, Alexander Haig, who at the time was the White House Chief of Staff. And those are the people that I am aware of that knew, you know, a day or two before.
Right.
People I know that did not know were people like Steve Bull, who was President Nixon's appointment secretary, the person who would actually usher people in and out of the Oval Office and keep the president on schedule. I was in his office, I think, three times that day, working on a monitor that was in his office that wasn't working properly, and he was indicating to friends on the phone that he did not know what was going to be said, and he did not know if he would have a job the next day, which, incidentally, he did not have a job the
right,
next day.
Right.
A little later that evening, we were sent to the Oval Office, and that was my first time to actually be in there, and two of us from White House Communications Agency, a couple of Secret Service agents, and maybe one or two White House staff people were in there. At the time, we began to set up the office. We covered the desk with a kind of a almost like a brown blanket. Helped the CBS crew at that time, and I'm sure it's still this way today. When the president speaks, it's done in by a pool. And there's a rotation of who has the pool, and that particular night CBS had the pool, which means that the CBS cameraman and the CBS van would set up on the South Lawn. The CBS cameramen and their equipment would be set up in the Oval Office, and then their feed would go to the van, and from the van it would feed the other networks. So if you flip through the channels when the president's on TV, you're seeing the exact same thing because there's only one set of cameras, but it's feeding multiple multiple outlets. So we went in and did that setup, and I believe when we went live with the resignation speech, there was, I believe, three or four people in the room other than him, two CBS cameramen, myself, and I think one other person. No Secret Service, no photographers, no other people. So I began to realize, as I began to think through this a couple of months ago about this being 40 years, that there were four major events that took place in about 18 hours. The resignation speech itself, and then the next morning in the East Room on August 10th, I think it would have been, Nixon's farewell to the White House staff.
Very emotional. Very emotional.
Amazing. It's probably the only time that, and I was 24 at the time, it's probably the only time that I had heard Richard Nixon speak really from the heart. And there wasn't a dry eye in the place. And then the departure, the helicopter departure on the South Lawn and the swearing in of Gerald Ford. And I was personally there for each one of those. And I have a pretty strong feeling that I'm the only person that was.
That is
and the
incredible.
Reason I feel that way is because of the Nixon resignation speech. I think there was only five of us in the room counting President Nixon.
Did it shake you up, realizing what was going on at the time?
Yeah, I mean, it still to this day makes the hair stand up on the back of my neck to think about it. I remember when Nixon, President Nixon, walked in the room, that I had this almost overwhelming desire to go up to him and tell him not to give up and to fight it. Even though I had no business doing that, I didn't do it. It would have been highly inappropriate. But, you know, he was the president of the United States. And I was, a very junior member on the military staff. And it was gut-wrenching, really, to watch him walk in and humiliated and resign the presidency. It was just an incredible thing to just stand there and watch that take place. And then, of course, over that period of 18 hours or so, there was a dramatic change in the atmosphere of the White House, almost unimaginable. The change in the feeling when the helicopter took off with Nixon and President and Mrs. Ford turned around and walked back into the East Room for the swearing in, and then it was just almost like things had gone back to the way they were supposed to be.
Yeah,
back to some kind of normalcy, because the Watergate thing was overwhelming to the entire country, and especially those of us who worked there. I remember that at one point I wanted to buy a car, and just before the Nixon resignation, and I went to a car dealer and went to a bank, I think, and they said, where do you work? And I said, I was pretty proud. I said, I work at the White House. And they said, oh, sorry, we can't make any loans at this time to people who work at the White House.
I mean, the sense of relief I have to feel was in there, especially if you look at the personalities of the two men, and you bring in a guy like Gerald Ford, who's just a calm, easygoing, kind of a regular American kind of guy. It just had to be a relief to everybody, everybody that was going to stay there. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, and to jump ahead just a little, I'll jump ahead about a year, Mrs. Ford was actually taking myself, my mother, and my grandmother through a personal tour of the second floor of the White House, which is the floor that they live on, which also has the Queen's bedroom, the Queen's sitting room, the Lincoln bedroom, the Lincoln sitting room, and a few other historical rooms. And when we got into the Lincoln sitting room, she asked us if we could smell the smell of smoke. And we all said, yes, we can. And she said, well, feel the walls, and you'll feel that the wall coverings are not like wallpaper. It's not a hard wall. It was padded wall. And the wall coverings were soft, and behind them was some type of padding. And she said the smoke smell is from President Nixon spending his evenings and late into the night in this room prior to the resignation in August, July and August of 1974, when it was hot, really hot in Washington. And they would run air conditioning and have a fire for him because he wanted a fire. And so he would burn a fire in there every night, sit by that fire and contemplate his future, I guess. And the smoke a year later still permeated that room.
You'll hear more from Bill Brockett, an eyewitness to the last days of Richard Nixon's presidency, and a man who had a fascinating relationship with President Gerald Ford, in a moment. You are listening to America's Great Conversations on The Stephen Manchie Show.
Provocative guests, real interviews, surprising answers. This is The Stephen Manchie Show.
Are you paying cash for prescription medications? Then our free pharmacy discount card is for you. You can save up to 85% off prescription medications at over 65,000 pharmacies in the U.S., including all major chains. Everyone qualifies. The cards are activated and they never expire. To get your free pharmacy discount card today, call 888-650-3051. Again, 888-650-3051.
It seems like every time we go to the gas pump, the price is up. Across the nation, the price of gas is approaching $5 a gallon, and experts are predicting it will go even higher. What if I told you there is something you can do about it, and at the same time help preserve the environment? A company called Global Ecological Solutions has developed one of the most efficient, practical, and reliable hydrogen-on-demand generators available. This product will increase your miles per gallon by 25 to 45%, increase your horsepower while extending the life of the engine, and drastically reduce exhaust emissions by as much as 75%. You save money, help preserve the environment, and extend the life of your engine. To learn more, go to the website at www.geshho.com or call 650-273-6116 to learn more. That number is 650-273-6116, and the website is geshho.com. And tell them you heard it on Free America Radio. In case you just joined in, I'm Stephen Manchie, and my guest is Bill Brockett, who is just sharing his unique experience of seeing Richard Nixon's final days in office, including his resignation speech, his address to the White House staff, and his final helicopter trip from Washington. So let's talk about how you got from Nixon to Ford. As you said, a lot of people lost their jobs. There was a transfer of power, as there always is with the new president and so forth. So how do you catch on with Gerald Ford? And you know, all of a sudden you have a new position and everything. Talk about that, because I think it's really interesting.
The military staff that supports the president directly, which would be like his military aides, the people who carry the nuclear suitcase, which are always right around the corner, those people are on the on the military. They're considered the military staff, and then the White House Communications Agency, which is also part of the military staff, is kind of a separate entity. So I was in the White House Communications Agency. So the biggest change that happened right away was I worked in videotape recording. Now we had people that worked in audio tape recording. So typically if the president was out in public and he was speaking, or even if he was speaking to reporters or whatever, some of our people would have shotgun mics, and those mics would be pointed up toward him, and they would have recorders that they wore over their shoulders, and they would audio record everything that he said. We video recorded all presidential speeches and news and all that sort of thing. So when President Ford first came in office, he said, no recording. And when the president says no recording, that means no recording. So everything shut down. All recording devices were turned off. And so then they had to, his senior staff, people had to go to him and say, that's kind of a sweeping thing to say, and it's really affecting our ability to do our jobs. And I think what you may have meant was no recording of private conversations that take place, like the Butterfield tapes, you know, that
right,
were
exactly.
The recorders that were in the Oval Office. And that's exactly what he meant.
You changed some of the things you did. I mean, one of the things, become the trainer of the dog, which is fascinating. And from there, actually getting the president's ear, I think it's an incredible story. Talk about that, because this is, you know, you became more than just a guy on the communications team in the Ford administration.
Sure. Well, what happened was shortly after the Fords came in office, they came in August, and it was probably in late September maybe, Mrs. Ford was diagnosed with breast cancer, which anybody who was around back in that day is certainly aware of. And she went to Bethesda Naval Medical Center for surgery. And when she did, their daughter, Susan Ford, and the White House photographer, David Kennerly, two people that I still am in contact with to this day, Susan and I are good friends, they decided to get the president a golden retriever. And the Fords had had one before, and they just thought it would be good for him to have one. So this is my understanding of it. And so they found an 8-month-old golden retriever female, which they purchased and gave to President Ford. When Liberty came, it was news, of course, and we worked in videotape recording the news, so I knew right away that the president had gotten a retriever. I had this background in dog training that was mostly with retrievers, Labradors and Chesapeakes primarily, but also with Goldens. And so I kiddingly, up in my office, I said, I should put in for the job of White House dog trainer. And keep in mind, I had been there at that time about 2 months, 2.5 months, something like that. And I said it to a guy who'd been there about 8 years. And so he asked me some questions. He said, do you actually know how to train dogs? And I said, yeah, I've been pretty successful at it and had some national level dogs. And yeah, I can do that. So he kind of took it from there. He let some people that he knew in the West Wing know that the White House Communications Agency had a guy in videotape recording who had the background to train the president's dog. So I think in maybe about 4 or 5 days, I came to work and there was a note on my desk that said, call Susan Ford or David Kennerly about training the president's dog. And I thought, well, I'm not calling Susan Ford. So I called David Kennerly.
And you'll find out more about that call to David Kennerly in just a moment. You're listening to former presidential advisor to Gerald Ford, Bill Brockett. This is the Stephen Manchie Show.
Check us out on Twitter at twitter.com/Stephen Maggi Show. This is the Stephen Maggi Show.
What can you do to prevent mosquitoes from spreading West Nile virus? The most important thing you can do is get rid of standing water on your property now. That's where mosquitoes breed. Don't leave standing water in outside pet water bowls, old tires, potted plants, anything that holds stagnant water. Dump birdbath water and replace every 2 or 3 days. Drain and cover unused swimming pools. Let's do it together and hit mosquitoes where they breed. Learn how at beyondpesticides.org/mosquito. A public service message from Beyond Pesticides.
You may not realize it, but there's a source of renewable energy right in your neighborhood, and you're helping to power it. Today, Waste Management is using the resources at our disposal to create energy from waste. Enough green energy to power over 1 million homes. It's an idea we're proud to drive forward. From everyday collection to environmental protection, think green. Think Waste Management.
Glad you're here. You're listening to the Stephen Manchie Show. I'm Stephen, along with former presidential advisor to President Gerald Ford, Bill Brockett. Now, Bill, you were saying that when you first joined the Ford staff as the official trainer to the first dog, Liberty, you got a call from White House photographer David Kennerly. What did he say?
He asked me to come down to his office in the West Wing, and I went down there, and that was the first time he and I met. So we talked, and he said, it sounds like you know what you're doing. Do you happen to have a dog that you could... That you could bring up and show us what you can do? And I said, well, I do. I happen to have a dog right now, a Chesapeake Bay Retriever from California that I helped train, kind of co-trained. A friend of mine owned, and he and I trained together for years. And I said, it's an amazing dog that I'd be happy to bring up. So we made arrangements for David, Mrs. Ford, Susan, and their Secret Service agents to meet on the South Lawn. And so when he got done, made all five retrieves, I turned around and David was talking to Mrs. Ford. And then he turned to me and he said, you want the job? And I said, sure. And he said, you got it. And I worked President Ford's dog before I went to my regular job. So it was just a volunteer job that I did.
It's incredible. So tell us about your first encounter with the president and how that developed into something beyond just dog training.
Well, the first thing that I realized was that this dog, eight months old and no training, and had been with a family that had little kids. And I'm not sure exactly what the circumstances were of how they came to get this dog. But the dog had no training. In fact, what it had was anti-training, I would say. It would run. If you threw something for it, it would take it and run away and all that. So the first thing that I did was I told... I think it was the White House usher's office. I said, in order to train this dog, I've got to take it home. I can't train it here because it's just, I'm going to have to use some discipline on it, not abuse it or anything, but use some discipline that if the press saw, you may remember, Stephen, back in the days when Lyndon Johnson picked up one of his beagles by its ears.
Oh yeah, it was
and,
a huge
and
story.
The press was there, and oh my God, I mean it was unbelievable. It was like the biggest story of the year, and people who were around back then still remember it. It was unbelievable how cruel he was to this dog and all, you know, and it didn't hurt the dog really at all. But so I did take Liberty home for 3 weeks, if I remember correctly, and kept her at home, and when I'd go to work, she'd stay home, and nobody in my neighborhood knew who she was or anything, and worked her at home. And then finally brought her back up to the White House, you know, and at that point I had her where she would heal. She would come when she was called and so forth. Well, the first encounter that I had with President Ford, and I honestly don't remember if it was before or after I took her home, but he was at the Army-Navy game in, I believe, Philadelphia, Soldiers Field, I think, and... So this would have been, I believe, in late October. And when the helicopter came in on the South Lawn and landed, I decided to go out, have Liberty out in the Rose Garden so that she could begin to get used to the sound of the helicopter coming in, because I knew she'd eventually be riding on the helicopter. And so I was just kind of standing in a corner of the Rose Garden, out of the way, and the president and his whoever was with him, they got off the helicopter and began to walk to the residence, which they would walk into what's called the diplomatic reception room on the south portico, right in the middle of the residence. And just before he got to the door of the residence, he caught a glimpse of me over in the Rose Garden, and he just made a beeline for me. And I remember thinking, oh, my God, he's coming over here. And I didn't know what to say, what he was going to be like. I knew really nothing about him. And he walked up to me, and at that time I was an E5, basically you might say a sergeant in the Army. I was actually a specialist 5, but same as a sergeant. And he walked over to me, reached out his hand, and he said, "How are you, sir?"
Wow.
And that was our first meeting. And when he called me sir, that was really bizarre to me. But as I got to know him better, I realized that was
the kind of guy he is. Huh? Yeah.
Exactly. And right then he established a respect. I mean, to me, respect works to, you know, both ways. And I had great respect for him. I mean, you respect the office no matter who's in there. But in his case, I developed a tremendous respect for him. But, you know, those few words that he said in our very first meeting, "How are you, sir?" Just set the stage for an amazing friendship over the years.
I want to talk about Ford's time in office, because, you know, he gets ignored, and I think it's really unfair because he was in such a difficult time. Everybody just talks about the pardon, and we're going to definitely talk about the pardon, but a lot of things went on at that time. For starters, it was a time when we evacuated our forces out of Vietnam, probably one of the most contentious moments in American history, again, was the Vietnam War. Talk about his feelings on that and how you feel, you know, he handled all that.
There's some things I have to be very careful about.
Yeah.
That I can't say, but I can say this. I know that Gerald Ford called in General Wayand, and General Wayand, I believe at that time was the Army Chief of Staff, so he would have been the Chief of the Joint Staffs was an Air Force General. Can't actually remember his name, but General Wayand would have been the most senior Army General, I believe. And he did call General Wayand in to the Oval Office and asked him to go to Vietnam and assess the situation, because it was really bad, and report back to him within, you know, so many days. And I know that David Kennerly, who was President Ford's photographer and also the President Ford's really close friend and confidant, who was probably at that time 27, maybe. He, after General Wayand left the office, it's my understanding that David said to President Ford, "Let me go over there with him, and I will bring you back my assessment." That's probably how I should word it. And President Ford went along with that. I believe that his report that he came back with is the one that President Ford took the most serious, thought was the most accurate report. And so decisions were made, I think, based on what David told the president that he observed, undoubtedly some of what General Wayand observed too, but I just feel like a lot of weight was put on what David found, because he went out and actually talked to the people who were in the field that were under fire and went out and assessed the situation, you know, right in the heat of battle.
Well, and that speaks a lot to Ford's character again, because, you know, from all our conversations, he was always looking for people who'd be honest with him. He wasn't looking for the yes men, and not that type of guy at all, and wanted to really make decisions based off facts that he felt were accurate.
Well, and I think that's how he and I built a really good relationship. Is my relationship with him in the beginning had nothing to do with my military assignment. If there had been no golden retriever named Liberty, I quite likely never would have even shaken hands with him. That, you know, there are special advisors to the president. That's a particular position that a person holds. I've always felt like I was an advisor. I advised him about his dog, for one thing, but then it went considerably beyond that. And we had discussions about all kinds of things. So I've said over the years that I was the youngest personal advisor to President Ford. And that's not an actual position.
And one of the big areas, and again, I don't think he gets enough credit for, was his dealing with the Cold War, because the Cold War was certainly alive and well back then. And while President Nixon had made some really incredible diplomatic moves with some of his staff, of course, China and Russia, that was a time when we were vulnerable because the rest of the world really didn't know how we were going to handle this. And it seemed like President Ford did just a fine job in terms of keeping all the positives that were going on without scaring off any of our allies or emboldening any of our enemies.
Well, yeah, I think that's true. And, that's delving into some areas that I'm not as privy to as some others. But I do feel like he was, Gerald Ford was well prepared for what came his way. People who were prepared to do a certain thing that happened to be in the right place at the right time. Gerald Ford had a good military background, a good congressional background. He was well-respected in Congress on both sides of the aisle.
You will hear more from presidential advisor to President Ford, Bill Brockett, in just a few moments. You're listening to The Stephen Manchie Show.
You're listening to Stephen Maggi, host of one of America's top interview programs, The Stephen Maggi Show.
Does the cost of your prescription drugs drive you crazy? I mean, I know there are some things that even the best insurance won't cover, and other things where they just don't cover much. What can you do? Is there anything you can do? Yeah, there is. Call the folks at NDC, specifically my friend Mark Tolan, at 209-277-0930. That's 209-277-0930, and ask him for your free prescription card. You can get as many as you want. Mark will give you the kind of attention that you really need with this and answer any questions you might have. All he wants to know is what your address is, so he knows where to mail these to. There's no scam, no hustle or anything like that, but it can save you some money. It saves some people 50%, some even more. Find out how much it'll save you. Call Mark Toland at 209-277-0930. That's 209-277-0930. Or find out more about the NDC discount cards at ndcdiscountcards.com. If you wonder how President Gerald Ford was able to work with a hostile Congress following Richard Nixon's resignation, the answer is simple: communication. Now, Bill Brockett, you saw this approach often in your times at the White House, didn't you?
This was related to me by Susan Ford. Her dad, before he became vice president, was the minority leader of the House. And if I remember right, Tip O'Neill at the time was majority leader of the House. And I think
right.
the Speaker of the House was Carl Albert, if I remember right. And so Tip O'Neill, who was pretty staunch Democrat, and Gerald Ford, who I don't consider a staunch Republican, but he was definitely a Republican. They lived in this. They had the same jobs on the opposite sides of the aisle. They lived in the same neighborhood. Their kids went to the same schools. Their wives were both members of the Congressional Wives Club, and they lived close enough to each other that that Tip O'Neill and Gerald Ford would visit each other's homes in the evenings, many nights a week, I think, and sit in their den after dinner, and maybe the kids had gone to bed or something, and smoke their pipes and drink whiskey and work together to figure out how to get bills through Congress that would benefit the country. And those days, they went somewhere. I'm not sure exactly where they went, but they don't really exist anymore. So,
yeah, sounds unusual in this day and age, Bill.
And so, you know, Tip O'Neill was a regular visitor to the Oval Office, and he was there because Gerald Ford respected him and wanted to understand where, you know, the other side, if you will, what their thinking was.
Well, he's probably best known for, and his most difficult decision, and that was the pardon of Richard Nixon. And I mean, he had people upset on both sides of the aisle with this thing. And yet, when we look at it through the lens of history, it seems like it was a great decision as we look back.
Well, you know, I became aware of something, and this is a term applied to him that I would have resented ever hearing until I heard it from Bob Woodward in a group discussion that I saw on TV just a few months ago. The Nixon pardon came 31 days after President Ford became president, and there's actually a book called 31 Days that talks about it. And it was a really difficult time because the Watergate situation and the Nixon cover-up and all of that, it didn't go away with the resignation. In fact, it may have even heated up. And I think Leon Jaworski, I believe, was the special prosecutor. He was under a lot of pressure to indict Nixon. And the press conferences that President Ford would have were dominated by the Nixon possible prosecution and so forth. And I think that President Ford struggled with that. I know that he discussed it with, I've read that he discussed it with aides of his. It was the political people were against it. I'm not sure if there were hardly any people who were for, on his staff, you know, that were for a pardon for Nixon, because I think they realized what it would do to him politically. It would be devastating. Bob Woodward was asleep, apparently, or just waking up or something, the morning of the pardon, which would have been around September, 10th, 11th, 12th, something like that, of 74. And Carl Bernstein, who was his partner in the Watergate reporting for the Washington Post.
Yeah.
He called Bob Woodward, and he said, "The son of a bitch pardoned the son of a bitch." And like I say, I mean, I respect Gerald Ford so much that I never thought I would hear anybody use those words about him. But it wasn't referring to him that way. It was Bernstein's way of saying, "I can't believe this has happened." And but history has shown that it was the right thing to do, I think. And I think the best example of that is Ted Kennedy, and I think you and I talked about this. Ted Kennedy was livid about the Nixon pardon, one of the most outspoken against it. And years later, he and Caroline Kennedy actually awarded President Ford the Kennedy Medal of Freedom, or whatever the Kennedy Medal is called, for the Nixon pardon. That's what the medal was given for the courage that it took to give the Nixon pardon. So even Ted Kennedy came full circle on it and realized that there was just no real reason to continue on with that, and that it wasn't that Nixon deserved a pardon. It was that the country and the White House, the West Wing, they needed to move on beyond that, and it was like they were caught in quicksand. Imagine, if you would, that that we had found out, the powers that be back there had found out about Spiro Agnew and Richard Nixon in reverse.
Right.
A lot of people don't even remember, or they don't even know the name Spiro Agnew, but Spiro Agnew was the vice president of the United States under Richard Nixon. And Spiro Agnew was about to be indicted. So imagine, if you would, that the Nixon situation had taken place first, and then the vice president had become president, and then been indicted, and then put in prison.
Yeah, and he was hated more than Nixon was, really, by the press and by some of the folks on the other side of the aisle. So, I mean, there would be no hesitation to keep him in as well. And that's why Gerald Ford was such a great pick. I mean, getting back to Ford, he was really a great pick for Nixon. And do you think that the folks in Congress had an idea that, hey, if this happens, we know we can trust this guy?
Well, yeah, I think it's my understanding that what happened was that Nixon, from what I've been told, President Nixon really wanted John Connally. And John Connally was the former governor of Texas, was in the limousine with John Kennedy when he was assassinated, was a pretty staunch Democrat, but had converted to the Republican side. And the feeling was that John Connally was electable as president if he were to decide to run. And so it's my understanding that Nixon's first choice was John Connally, because he felt like John Connally could carry on the mantle, you know, the Republican presidency. And the Democrats in Congress, they didn't want that. so it became obvious that Nixon needed to replace the vice president. And so he asked the Democratic leadership in the Congress to send him a list of people that they felt like they would approve. And they, from what I've been told, they sent a list with one name on it, which was Gerald Ford. And I would assume that it was partly political, in that they felt that Gerald Ford was not well known outside the Beltway, really outside Congress, which he wasn't.
Thanks for joining me today. Bill will be back later this year to discuss more about President Ford, the man. And please visit the Stephen Maggi Show at stephenmaggishow.com to listen to extensive interviews with Bill Brockett. That's coming up in just a couple weeks. You've been listening to the Stephen Maggi Show.
Have a suggestion for a future program? Email us at info@stephenmaggishow.com. This is the Stephen Maggi Show.